Okay, so good morning everybody. I hope you enjoyed our first workshop day yesterday, and we are very much looking forward to another exciting workshop day today. Yesterday we had a closer look on the clinical role of epigenetic changes, and today we will more dig into the adaptive role of epigenomics. And with this, I give over to Amber, who will have the first talk today. Amber is one of the organizers, and she is also a postdoc doctoral fellow with our two hosts, Thomas Elbert and Axel Meyer. Amber's research is focusing on live bearing fish, and I'm very much excited to hear that.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I really appreciate everybody participating. So as one of the organizers, it's good to see so much output, especially from the speakers and the participation and motivation that we're getting from you guys. I'm going to be talking a little bit of what I've been doing at the University of Konstanz, working with Thomas Elbert and Axel Meyer, using these beautiful fish. So these are Basiliid fish, and I'll go in more into their biology and their ecology in just a bit. First, I want to give you a general background refresher, since it was a long night. Some of you guys might have had a lot of liquid beverages. So just a brief reminder, there's three main modes. It looks like something's getting cut off. Oh, well. There's three main modes of epigenetic processes. So you have the RNA microprocesses. You have the histone markers. But you also have DNA methylation. That is the one marker that I'm very interested in. So just as a refresher, DNA methylation is when a methyl group is attached to a cysteine, or a cytosine, sorry, at the CpG sites through these methyl transferases. And when it's located on a promoter region of a gene, it actually starts to manipulate how the gene expression occurs. So it can turn off a gene, or it can enhance a gene in the sense of more gene expression. So there's been a lot of research, especially from what we heard yesterday, about DNA methylation and the environment. We know that hunger is a huge factor, and there's been a lot of links between methylation and hunger. Either being hungry or even very fatty type diets can influence the methylation pattern of offspring and the individual. But also things like physical abuse, like what we heard from Thomas Elbert, and then smoking from a little bit of what we might hear from Rob. But the thing is, all of these are some sort of stress on the body. It's reacting to the body. It's going to influence the types of methylation patterns we see. Now, we got to define stress, and everybody defines stress differently. I'm going to be focusing on the HPA axis. We all had a great introduction to this from the three talks we heard yesterday that involved this HPA axis. I just want to mention that, first of all, it is evolutionary adaptive to specific environments. Okay, that's something that people don't really realize. The acute stress is adaptive to all environments. But you can get to where you get chronic stress, which I'll explain in a little bit more detail. But that can actually be adaptive to specific environments. It's also conserved across almost all vertebrate species. They have some form of this HPA axis, which makes it really good to study in an evolutionary perspective of how animals can adapt to different environments. Now, chronic stress is when we get a long period of exposure of some event. This could be emotionally, through emotional abuse, or it can be an attack, so an external pressure onto you. But what it does is it prevents this homeostasis and this negative feedback within the HPA axis. So you get a buildup of cortisol in the bloodstream, and this has many, many negative effects across the body physiologically. So it can shut down reproduction. It could prevent you from feeling much pain. It can also decrease digestion, increase glucose, and many, many more. And a lot of people, such as Thomas again, has looked at mental illness. And also Chris has looked at this too with the depression. So this has a lot of profound effects. Again, animals show these similar behaviors across all vertebrates. But what's really interesting is these events can occur in different modes, you could kind of think of it as. So stress in nature usually comes in three different forms. You have the adaptive response to a predator. You want to escape the predator and live. So all these modes of of processing, so reducing your pain, so if you're injured, you can escape. You can also have the effects of starvation, and this could have some sort of, or at least in the human models, psychological effects processing through this HPA axis. There's also other abiotic factors that we can also look at, such as you could think of it as prior to fish kills, these fish were stressed because there was a toxin in the water, some sort of pollutant, maybe an algae bloom, so stress on the respiration. It's still triggering the same axes. So there's many, many ways to influence this axis in the natural environment. What I will be focusing on today is predation, the easiest one to manipulate in a lab. Specifically, I want to know, how does predatory stress influence the behavior and epigenetic processes of the offspring, or the prey of the offspring? So I use live-bearing fish. So if you go into an aquaria store and you see mollies, swordtails, guppies, plattyfish, you should be able to recognize the kind of fish that I work with, right? These are very small fish. Some of them are even extremely tiny. They're normally very social. Okay, people don't really put social behaviors with these type of fish, but they're actually really, really social fish. But what makes them a great model is that they have short generation times, so they usually reproduce every 24 to 30 days, depending on the species. We can use them in the lab and manipulate different environments, and they respond really well to that manipulation. They have no parental care beyond giving birth. So there's nothing that the mother does beyond giving birth, and actually she can eat her offspring if you don't remove them fast enough. So there's absolutely no parental care in this system. But what's really, really cool about these fish is they have what we call a follicular placenta. So each offspring has this thin tissue layer that is technically called a placenta. However, the structure and the complexity of this placenta could vary between what we term non-placental fish and placental fish. Placental fish are very, very much like mammal fish. They provide a lot of nutrients and hormonal transfer between the mother and the offspring during pregnancy. So what you have is you have a small ova, or small ova that are fertilized, and they actually increase in size prior to birth because the mother's giving additional nutrients throughout the pregnancy. Now, what we call the non-placental fish have a very, very ancestral type structure of a placenta. They pack in all the nutrients before fertilization. So what they can do is pack in a bunch of environmental cues into this yolk, and then fertilization occurs. But the offspring only uses that which is in the yolk to sustain itself during development. So you have a large ova, and then it decreases in size at birth. So we have these two different systems that are found across the entire family of fish. So now we can look at the evolutionary perspective across different species, which is really, really cool. So these fish have a lot of predators. If you're this big, you're very, very low on the food chain. So you have birds, so they have the aerial predators. They have fishing spiders, so you kind of see this molly here that this fish, or that this spider has trapped. And they can actually be pretty freaky because they're on the wall and they'll dive down if you're trying to seine for the fish. Not a fun experience. Crayfish, so if you ever get the glory to seine for these fish and you get crayfish in the net, they will actually start going after your fish and killing them, so you need to get them out fast because they really, really love feeding on these fish. It's easy prey. But even aquatic bugs can prey on these fish. And these bugs are only this big, so they're almost as big, if not smaller, than these fish. Okay. But what I'm interested in, or at least the predator that I'm really interested in, is the piscivorous fish. And so you can see this cichlid here with a very unfortunate guppy hanging out of its mouth. So these fish are really cool. Let's see if I could get this to play. Okay, so you see this fish here. If you can have good vision, there's a, well, it's now here, 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 and here. So these are juvenile psylliids, and they're exhibiting very good anti-predator behaviors. So what they do is they stay at the surface, because as you can tell, the predator really has the ground covered. And they have this really jerky C-start motion, which is a really fast escape behavior. And what's really important is these behaviors are specific only when a predator is around. So right now, they're experiencing what we call chronic stress, because they can't escape from the predator. They are stuck in the same environment as a predator, so you have a continual process of trying to escape. However, you can tell, since they're not down here, they're not going to be foraging. Okay? If these were adults, they would not be breeding. So it's very, very negative in specific environments. So that's really what we want to emphasize here, is that these behaviors are adaptive only when a predator is around. And another thing before I switch this is these offspring have never experienced a predator. So theoretically, it's predicted that these anti-predator behaviors are actually a fallback behavior. So they are very conditioned to it, and what happens when they relax these behaviors, that is a learned behavior. So these fish, like I said, cichlid, are really the big predators of these fish. There are some other species or other groups of fish that also like to eat on them, but cichlids are really the main predator. And if you think about it, cichlid, they can influence behaviors to the father and the mother. And hypothetically, you would expect it to be similar. And then that would then be information transferred to the offspring. However, males and females can actually transfer stress or transfer the signal that there's predators in the environment differently. So how can we think of transferring stress? There are different types of exposure rates. You can expose individuals to stress either right before fertilization. So you can think of males, they constantly reproduce sperm, and so they can constantly incorporate the environmental variables into the DNA, potentially through microRNAs, methylation, or etc. Females can have a different option. Okay, so it's a similar if you have a non-placental individual, because the mother packs in all the environmental cues into the yolk. So think of a chicken. She packs in all the environmental cues, the egg is then fertilized and out of the body. There's nothing else a female does with it. However, as soon as you evolve a placenta, you've got a different layer that can add complexity to the situation. So if you think of mammals, you have the grandmother that's stressed, and we've heard this before in previous talks yesterday, her F1 and her grandchild are also exposed to that stressful event. So which is more important? Is it the stress that occurs right before fertilization, or is it the stress that happens during pregnancy? And that's what we're really able to ask with this Pacillid system, is we can understand the types of roles the placenta might play in regulating epigenetic changes. So going to my fish, I have at the very top, so right here, this will be our guppy. This is a non-placental species. So they don't invest very much into their offspring after fertilization. This species down here is what we call our placental species. So she constantly has this exchange of hormones. She is constantly providing nutrients to this offspring. So there's communication back and forth during the entire pregnancy that lasts about 24 days. So really what we want to know is not only do how males and females differ, but really how these non-placental individuals respond differently or similarly to the placental individuals. On both the anxiety or predator, anti-predator behaviors and the methylation of the F1 offspring. Also, really emphasizing the role of the placenta, what the evolution of the placenta can influence these type of behaviors. So how did I do this? So we have what we term a sump tank, and this tank actually has the filter, and it filters water into a tank up here. And this is clean water, so it's our non-stress environment, our control environment. Down here, we placed a predator. And so these waterborne predator cues, these pheromones, are transferred from this tank into the tank with the fish. So these fish are only experiencing waterborne predator cues. Okay? And that's what's really important. They have no experience, but they're experiencing these cues. And so we can do this in a larger setup, so we have a lot of replication. And we do it for both the two species. And so what's really important, because these fish are extremely social, we expose females and males. So they're in social groups that are single-sexed, so they're not going to stress each other out, and they're not going to breed during these experiments. Okay, so to verify that these fish are indeed stressed, so these are the adults, the parents, what we did is we looked at where they are in the tank. So if you recall the video, all the offspring was at the top of the tank. So that is our stressed behavior. And we are indeed seeing that our stressed individuals are more likely to be at the top of the tank than randomly throughout it like our non-stressed individuals. And that goes for males and females of both species. Okay, so going back to our experimental design, once we verify that the adults are indeed stressed, we then do a crossbreeding treatment where we breed a control male with a control female for our control group, a control male with a stressed female for our maternal stress group, a stressed male with a control female for our father, our paternal group that's stressed, and then our two stressed individuals, so our double stressed group. Now, what's really important is all the offspring were raised in a control environment. Okay, so they experienced no predator cues. It's only deemed through the information of the parents. So hypothetically, the genetics, or at least that's what you would hope, right? What we do then is we get this petri dish, and this petri dish, we have it in a gray area and a white area. And so stressed individuals, you would expect to prefer the dark, to prefer the edges, to shoal tighter, and move slower, travel more distance, that sort of behavior. So those are the stress behaviors we're measuring. Next, we then sadly terminate everyone and dissect out their brains. And this, we are using whole brains because these fish brains are extremely small, and so we wouldn't be able to get enough DNA for our next step, which is the DNA methylation. Now, I'm using candidate gene approach, so it's just direct sequencing with a candidate gene just to establish that this system is indeed working, and we could then go through whole genome methylation. But that's in the future. Right now, it's only candidate gene. Okay, so here's what we predict. If we have methylation and we have offspring from stressed parents, we're expecting them to have more methylation in their what we call the glucocorticotropin-releasing hormone receptor. So this is at the very end of the feedback, and so this is what incorporates and gets the signal of your cortisol. And then we also expect less of the CRH. So this is a hormone that's the first response to any type of environmental stressor. But we also expect females that have placentas to be the main influencer on their behaviors and the methylation. And then I will show you two of the behavioral measurements. So distance traveled. So if the offspring are from stressed parents, you expect them to travel less distance. And the other one is max velocity. So this is having a higher burst speed. If you recall the video again and you saw the offspring escaping the predator, that's that max burst speed, okay? So you really want a high max burst speed in order to escape predators. So looking at the CRH, so again, this is at the very beginning of this stress axis. And here's our non-placental individuals, and it looks like both stressed males and females cause a decrease in methylation. Now here, this might be an artifact due to my low sample size. I wasn't able to recover enough DNA from those individuals, but the other two groups, they're pretty statistically, they've got a lot of power, so I'm going to take that as both males and females. Now, on the placental side, it's the female rather than the male that really influences this decrease in methylation across all offspring. And so we're starting to see a difference of how the placenta might play a role in the epigenetic effects. Now, to look at a different gene, so this is the receptor, so the very end of this feedback loop, we're seeing same pattern in our non-placental individuals, where males and females that are stressed have a significant effect on their offspring, except now it's reversed. So you're seeing offspring of stressed parents having higher amounts of methylation in their offspring. Here, again, the sample size to me as a behavioral ecologist isn't enough power, but we're definitely planning on increasing this soon. Now, the placental species, I think we'll have the next plate on tomorrow, maybe. So we can have that sequenced then. Right now, it's just waiting for us to finish processing. So I don't know the results of this yet, but from the tentative few individuals, it's looking along similar patterns. Now the behavior, so as I mentioned, our first measurement is distance traveled. So you expect them to travel quite a bit, and we're seeing that when compared to the control, it's really both individuals that are significantly different from the control group, but it's different. So males act one way, females act another way. So if you had a stressed mother, you're going to behave this way. If you had a stressed father, you're going to behave that way. And so we're seeing that difference here in our non-placental species. In our placental species, it's really our stressed females that are really different. And so these females are traveling much, much less, or at least the offspring of these females are traveling much, much differently, or covering less ground compared to any of the other individuals. What's interesting, though, is we're not sure if this is an additive effect here. where we're seeing opposite effects between stressed mothers and stressed fathers. And this is somewhere in between. This is something that we need to analyze, split up male offspring versus female offspring, and see if this might be more explained if we separate the offspring sexes. So that could be an influence on that. Now, the max velocity, so remember, this is that burst speed, that escape behavior, how fast they moved during this entire time. We're seeing that it's really the females that are having different effects. So stressed females of the non-placental species can move really, really fast. Okay, so this is good. This is a good escape behavior. On the other hand, our placental species, the stressed females move very, very slow. So, or at least offspring from stressed females and from both parental stress, they move very slow. So whether this is an adaptive behavior is arguable, but there's some sort of effect going on. And we're seeing these across most of the behavioral variables we measured. We're seeing different patterns where males influence certain behaviors, females influence other behaviors, and then sometimes we're seeing the complete opposite within the same behavior. Okay, so just to kind of wrap up, for our non-placental species, it's both male and female that influence DNA methylation in these two genes and the behaviors. They might differ in the directionality of these behaviors or the specific directionality of the methylation in the genes. Whereas placental species, it's really the stressed mother. So she is really regulating the methylation pattern and the behavior. Whether or not the directionality, again, is veritable, that has to be looked at in more detail. Maybe because these offspring are both male and female, we might see, again, a separation there. But the take-home message is that the placenta might have two modes of regulating this methylation. It can either block or even reduce the effects of the stress fathers, or what might be more convincing, it might be influencing the reprogramming event that happens during early stage development. So it's probably either or of those, but just something to keep in mind, pregnant women you want to be really nice to, because they really have a lot of regulation on your offspring's, or at least epigenetic processes. So I like to sum up by, first of all, thanking the Hector Fellow Academy, because this research is done as a interdisciplinary collaboration between labs, between the psychology department and evolutionary biology with Thomas Elbert and Axel. Definitely want to acknowledge Nadia, because she's my technician and who has really, really helped me process this data as, you know, speedily and efficiently as possible. And then also everybody who's helped me with this. And thank you for listening, and I'll take any questions.
So thank you, Emma, for giving us some insight into your daily work and the very nice results you already obtained, and cross fingers for the experiments tomorrow.
Thank you very much for the nice talk. I have a question, how you exactly did the experimental work? Once you cross your fish, the stressed female, the non-stressed male, is the female still stressed afterwards?
Yes.
Right, with
the eggs and the male? Yes, yeah. So this is not something that we can't really separate, and I was talking to Chris about this yesterday, is he can easily separate out prenatal and postnatal, right? So I can only stress them out before and during pregnancy. There's no postnatal. So, and I can't separate that out. So what I did was 30 days of stress, take them out, breed them, females go straight back into the treatment they originated from, and then as soon as the offspring are born, they're taken out and put into control environments. So they're stressed out throughout their entire pregnancy.
So it's not that they reprogram, okay, the stress is over, it's something else.
Yeah, no, no. It's exactly the same, so. Yes?
Do
Great talk, thank you for it. Just out of curiosity, how do you measure the maximum verbs?
So there's video tracking that you can use to follow certain individuals, and there's various measurements that it can take. And so it does minimum velocity, average velocity throughout this 10-minute period, and then max velocity. And that's really if they get startled by some shadow or something, that's them moving really, really fast. And so they measure the fastest time that these individuals move at a time. But you can actually go in more in depth for these fish and measure sea start type behaviors. And that's where you drop something on purpose into the tank, and they actually contort their body and react really fast to these stimuli. So, yeah. Yeah.
Offsprings in non-stress environment, mm-hmm. but then you show the petri dish. So I'm not sure. Did you call them in aquariums or in this?
No, they were in the same setup as adults. So there's no difference except it's just the behavioral test. Yeah. So we put them in a petri dish so we can actually have light and dark environments, and it's contrasting well with the offspring's color. And so we can track them using video tracking. But that was only for a 10-minute test. Then they went back into their control environment.
And then I have a question. You sampled them at a very early age, right? I wonder how it develops. Is it maybe only the babies are like this, or will it persist when they are adults?
So the methylation pattern was when they were adults. They were sexually mature because the brain, I didn't want to pool brains because they're so small. I wanted to have individual data points that I had correlated behavior and methylation data. So I terminated everybody after they were sexually mature, and so I can have a standardized brain size. But the behavioral tests were when they were juveniles. It was when they were 10 days old. So the next step would be to really try to break down time points and see how the methylation occurs as they age, then sexual maturity, and then as they senesce. So they go through their adult life and then end. So you can really get an overall picture. And that's something that we can do because these fish typically can last maybe a couple years in the lab, depending on the species. Some can last longer than that as individuals before they senesce and age really rapidly. But yeah, it's something that we can do. I just didn't want to pool data points at the very beginning. So everybody was sexually mature from methylation. Planning. Yes, tell the DFG people. So I have a DFG right now that's submitted to get at the whole genome effect. So, and not only just whole genome effect, but also testing more lethotrophic species and more matrotrophic species, or the placental and non-placental species. So we can actually get an evolutionary perspective of how the evolution of a really advanced placenta can play in regulating these epigenetic effects. So yeah.
What are predator cues soluble in the water? If it's, I thought it was that they see it's the size or darkness or something like that, but this is not transferred in the water. This must be odor molecules, or what is it?
So there's two predator cues that all fish can detect a predator using. So there's pheromones. Pheromones you could think of as waterborne pheromones. These every fish releases passively with their urine, and it just tells you, you know, who's in the environment. And then there's a second cue that all fish have, which are alarm cues. And so what happens is when a predator bites a prey and damages the skin cells, there's small cells underneath the layers of scales and such that are damaged, and they release a chemical into the water. And this will tell the other fish around them that there's a predator in the environment, they're hungry, they've been, you know, at least attempting to eat another individual, scatter, essentially. So they use these two alarm cues, and they actually last a while, or at least they can cover quite a bit of distance. And so what's happening with the sump tank system is there's a continue movement of water from the predator tank to these tanks and then back. And so this predator is getting the cues that there's prey in the environment, it's getting hungry, and the prey are noticing that there's a predator in the environment. And that's all it really is. So, yeah.
What do you think is the main function of epigenetic inheritance here? Is it to improve the predator avoidance of the offspring, or is it to reduce the deleterious impact of chronic stress on reproduction?
So, chronic stress is only occurring through specific environments. So I would probably go with the first, that it's preparing the offspring to live in a predator environment, in the sense that now if the offspring are used to this predator environment, they will adapt over time. If they are born from predator parents, but then they don't need it, this is something that we need to look at in longevity of these effects, because it might be to where these effects, if they are maintained throughout life, then they're maladaptive, and it's the latter. It's the chronic stress that's really negative. But if they are in a predator environment, they would adapt, and it would no longer be chronic.
But they already have a system that is highly plastic, right? So
they
could even just sense the environment themselves and react to that. They don't need the cues from the parents for that. So is it really adaptive to have this programming that might then be maladaptive because there are no predators?
Right. But so I have another study that an undergrad did, and he showed that offspring of stressed individuals survive more from, that's where these videos came from, they actually survive more often than offspring from control individuals. So it might enhance early in life predator escape behaviors, and then something either will be maintained or lost depending on the individual's own experience. So it might be this pre-programming for early life success. You could kind of think of it. So yeah. Yeah.
You've very nicely shown that stress of the parents changes both the methylation and the behavior, but you have not shown that actually it's the methylation that mediates or changes the behavior. And I wonder whether there is a way to show that, to prove causality. It may not be possible.
Right.
I'm not sure. We would have to manipulate specifically methylation of certain sites. I'm not sure. I'm also not sure whether we could work with knockout, because the glucocorticoid receptor is present in so many cells, so we really don't know. Maybe we also focus too much on the HPA axis. Mm-hmm. Because it could be so many other areas, like in the brain, I don't know the fish, humans have a lot of cortisol receptors in the areas of their brain.
So I am interested in looking at other genes that are involved with neural development during pregnancy. So that would be getting away from the HPA axis. So that might play a role as, you know, the development of the brain during pregnancy. Whether or not we can do knockouts, that's right now not... or at least available in these fish. So it would be really something that we can look at. Right now, it's really correlational. I have RNA to do gene expression, so I can get whether or not, you know, the correlation between methylation and gene expression, but between behavior and methylation right now, since this model system is young, I don't have that yet. So I'd really have to think about how to get at causal with these fish, because we can't do the knockouts, or at least at this moment.
Because this quickly, but I think that's a problem in the whole field. We have no really causal proof. We have no correlational evidence.
Right.
If there is one last question, because we need to keep a little time. Yes, where does someone
have a question? Yeah.
Sorry, just a comment. I might not have understood. So the offspring of the placenta and mother seem to escape less.
No. So what do you mean escape less? They move slower.
Yes, so do they, are they predated more compared to the offspring of the
non-placenta? Not from a separate study that from that video. All stressed offspring, or the majority of the stressed offspring, actually survived. And that was only maternal stress. So all those offspring only had the mother stressed. That's where we get to where we measured several behaviors and they're showing different effects. So that might not be the most important behavior for escaping at that, you know, mode of whatever. We could say that it's influence because it's actually reducing the speed, but there might be a different predator escape behavior that might be more successful at offspring survival ship. Yeah.
So end up we will be around the whole day, so if there are more questions, just make sure you catch her in the next coffee break. For now we switch over to